The following is an encore presentation of the World Vision Report.
The world has reached a disturbing milestone. One out of six people goes to bed hungry every night. Jacqueline Novogratz is one of the people trying to change that. So naturally, she went to Africa.
It was this young spirit with lots of confidence and energy. When I first arrived in the Ivory Coast, I was pretty much told in no uncertain terms that I was too young, not married, no children, didn't know Africa, and frankly wasn't wanted.
Luckily, she stuck around. Hear how Novogratz is already making a difference. And on the streets of Shanghai, a mobile popcorn vendor pops, well, whatever can pop.
There's so many things I can make with my popper. If it tastes good, I'll pop it.
Around the world with the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. There are more than a billion people in the world who are urgently hungry. That's according to the World Food Program. 200 million of them have just been added in the last 2 years, and the numbers continue to rise. We invited World Food Program spokesperson Bettina Luscher onto the show to help us understand these figures. Bettina, welcome to the World Vision Report.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you explain to us what has happened this year? Why do the numbers keep going up?
We are in the middle of a perfect storm. Everything has come together. First, there were skyrocketing food prices, so people couldn't afford any more the food that was on the shelves. Then the poorest of the poor were hit by the economic crisis. And suddenly, you know, their relatives working in richer countries didn't send them money anymore. Their jobs were lost. And on top of that, you have conflicts and wars, so people have to flee their villages and cannot work on their fields anymore. And on top of that, you've got climate change, more droughts, more floods. All of this is coming together. This is why today there are more than 1 billion people who are going hungry every day.
It seems somewhat counterintuitive that things keep getting worse because the richer countries in the West continue to pledge increasing amounts of money. Is this money not helping at all?
The aid money, whatever, just to give you an example of what we are doing, I think the World Food Program feeds every year more than 100 million people in over 70 countries every year. So the aid is reaching the people. But at the same time, the needs are so much bigger that that's why our work is so tough and difficult nowadays.
And obviously you're getting that message out. What kind of response are you getting from the United States and other wealthy countries?
I think that people are really getting the message. You know, the G8, when they were meeting in Italy, pledged $20 billion for food security to make sure that on one side there's immediate humanitarian need, but also that there's long-term, you know, agricultural development, because you have to do a two-pronged approach. You have to help now and you have to help in the long term. And so we are quite optimistic and hopeful that the leaders of the world have realized this and tackle this.
And is it a matter of getting the donors to cough up more money and buy more food and export it?
You have to do it on several levels. On one side, you need to help those who are hungry now. And what we are doing as an aid organization, we try to use our buying power to really make a difference on the ground. On one side, we bring food to people who are hungry, but as an aid organization, we spend like more than $1 billion a year just in developing countries, buying food from developing countries, meaning we're strengthening the local economies. We might buy it in one African country and bring it to the neighboring African country where there's a hunger problem.
What you're saying here is you're buying food locally and sometimes from the same village and giving it to people or to neighboring countries. But I thought there was no food.
Well, you have it sometimes that in one part of a country there might be a drought, and in another part of a country, you know, the harvests are doing just fine. So the problem is, how do you get the food from that one location to the other location? And sometimes there are no roads and there's nothing. So we have to bring it in from areas where there might be roads, or we have to fly it in. The problem is often access, that people cannot access the food. What we've seen with the economic crisis and with the food price crisis is that there might have been food on the shelves, but people were so poor they couldn't afford it anymore. Let me give you an example. In Kenya, for example, to buy a 90-kilo bag of maize, you know, a couple of years ago, you had to pay with one goat. If you sold one goat, you could buy a huge bag of maize. Nowadays, you have to sell four goats in order to get that bag of maize.
Because the price of food has gone up drastically.
The price of food has gone up, and because there is a drought, and because they have been having so many problems.
You're encouraged that wealthy Western nations are donating more money to end this food crisis. And yet I'm wondering how much the economic crisis is going to eventually divert these countries, because we've got our own problems at home. And how are you factoring that in?
You know, I mean, it's a very valid point. We totally understand and see that many countries have budget problems and have to have increased unemployment benefits and all kinds of these things. And we've seen it from some regions that we didn't get the donations anymore that we received a year ago. But at the same point, what you also have to see is what kind of huge, if you put a dollar in, what the huge output will be. So if people invest in like school feeding and make sure that this young generation that's growing up now is well fed and can grow and become really productive, then you also will solve many of the economic problems. And the other thing is also, I think that many governments realize that it's not just a humanitarian issue, it's also a political and a stability issue. Last year we saw food riots in over 30 countries. The government of Haiti fell because the people were rioting on the streets. And I think everybody is very aware of it, that a hungry man is an angry man. Smart decisions need to be taken now, and how we can tackle the hunger problem and how we can make sure that in a few years we are not going to have every sixth person hungry in the world anymore.
Bettina Luscher is a spokesman for the World Food Program. Bettina, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
So what do people in African villages do when they don't have enough money for food? We sent a reporter to a small village in Sierra Leone to find out. In Camoria, families hardly have any cash for food or anything else. They survive on what little they can grow on their farms. And the village women work hard to bring in a little extra. Reporter Rochelle Borlase has this story.
It's early evening outside of the village, and about two dozen women and girls wade through the dense forest, hacking down long, lean tree trunks. Once each woman pulls five trunks to the ground, she ties them together with vines. The trunks are known here as sticks, even though they're about 10 feet long and extremely heavy. Despite that, these women are somehow able to perch these long bundles onto their heads. Mary Cisse is one of the women chopping sticks today. She's a single mother of five. She isn't sure of her actual age, but thinks she might be 35. The bulging muscles on her back and arms prove years of hard labor. Every morning, Cisse leaves her village with a bundle of five sticks balanced on her head, hoping to sell them in the town of McKinney. It's about a 7.5-mile journey, one way, along a swampy path.
So you can strain a bush. Where you cut the stick for?
It is a struggle to cut down the sticks in the bush and to carry them all the way to McKinney. And some days, we don't even sell our sticks. If we are lucky, we sell and make $1 or $2. With that money, I will buy 2 or 3 cups of rice to feed my children. I'm alone. I have no husband. This is my struggle.
Many of the women in Camoria village have no husbands. Some die during the civil war, others because of illness. Some men have abandoned their families. Most of the women who are still married are just one of several wives. Either way, Mary Cisse says the responsibility for feeding their kids rests on their shoulders. It's 5 o'clock in the morning and the women and girls are getting ready to set off to the market in McKinney. They each grab their bundle of sticks and squat down to lift them onto their heads. It's a 4-hour journey. They'll wade through swamps and dodge large rocks. As the sun begins to rise, beads of sweat start to trickle down the faces of the women and girls. But no one complains about being tired. Along the way, the women are routinely stopped by a tax collector from the McKinney City Council. If the women want to continue their journey, they'll have to pay a fee of 8 cents each. It might sound like nothing, but that's almost 10% of what these stick sellers hope to make today.
I am doing what the chief tells me to do. If they don't pay the fees, I seize their sticks. When they get me the money, I give them back. Some I trust, so some I let them go because I know they will pay me upon returning from Makeni.
Mande Kamara is one of the women who hands over the money. She shakes her head in disgust and continues walking. She says people in town don't understand how difficult this work is.
Oh, dog leader, not they respect you to this stick there.
They laugh and humiliate us and say evil things. Instead of stealing and being a disgrace, we do this to feed our families.
In town, competition for the stick sellers is fierce. They park their bundles on a plot of land that serves as a stick market where they pay a small rental fee. More than 50 women gather here to sell their sticks, so it's a scramble to attract any buyer who comes along. As he's swarmed by sellers, customer Osman Sise finally settles on a bundle. He's using the sticks to fix up his home that was damaged during a rainstorm. He knows the effort that has gone into getting the wood here, but he can't afford to pay more than $1.50.
You go to the bush, it gets unreasonable. So if it's, how long then they count time for winner now?
We have no way to help these people. If we had capital, we could provide them with transportation so that when they come to sell their sticks, it could be easier. But there is no way to get a vehicle.
For the entire day, the women and girls squat on the dusty ground waiting for customers. 6 hours later, Mande Kamara is the only seller from Kamoria who's managed to sell her sticks. But she had to walk an extra 3 miles in order to do that.
I took them to the highway to Freetown, and someone bought them. Now, I'm going back home because I left my children there, and I am sure they've been crying all day.
Nearly 12 hours after their day started, the women and girls of Kamoria Village begin their long walk home. They've left their bundles at the stick market, hoping to sell them tomorrow. Along the way home, a man selling rice from the back of his bicycle pedals past the line of women. Mande Kamara yells after him to stop, but he keeps moving. Feeling defeated, she slumps on a log on the side of the road.
Some of them, not sorry for you.
Traders will ignore us when we try to buy something from them. They think we don't have any money.
1 mile outside of Kamoria, the women and girls stop to wash in a small pond. This is their last break before getting home. When they reach the village, some will cook for their families, while others will go back to the bush to cut more sticks for tomorrow. In Kamoria Village, Northern Sierra Leone, I'm Rochelle Borlase for the World Vision Report.
Jacqueline Novogratz is on the warpath. Her target? World poverty. That's next on the World Vision Report.
I'm Peggy Waymeyer, and this is the World Vision Report. Jacqueline Novogratz has an ambitious agenda. She wants to help end global poverty, and she's already made a dent. In 2001, Novogratz, a former investment banker, founded the Acumen Fund. It's turned the old charity model on its head. Instead of just giving away money, Acumen invests in businesses that bring life-changing products to poor people. Products like housing, clean water, and energy. Novogratz believes that pioneering entrepreneurs will ultimately find the solutions to global poverty. She's written a book on the subject. It's called The Blue Sweater. Why'd she call it that? We'll let her explain.
I want to start with a story, Ella Seth Godin, from when I was 12 years old. My uncle Ed gave me a beautiful blue sweater, at least I thought it was beautiful, and it had fuzzy zebras walking across the stomach and Mount Kilimanjaro and Mount Meru kind of right across the chest that were also fuzzy. And I wore it whenever I could, thinking it was the most fabulous thing I owned. Until one day in ninth grade, when I was standing with a number of the football players, and my body had clearly changed, and Matt Mussolino, who was
undeniably my nemesis in high school, said in a booming voice that we no longer had to go far away to go on ski trips, but we could all ski on Mount Novogratz. And I was so humiliated and mortified that I immediately ran home to my mother and chastised her for ever letting me wear the hideous sweater. We drove to the Goodwill, and we threw the sweater away somewhat ceremoniously, my idea being that I would never have to think about this sweater nor see it ever again. Fast forward 11 years later, I'm a 25-year-old kid working in Kigali, Rwanda, jogging through the steep slopes, when I see 10 feet in front of me a little boy, 11 years old, running toward me wearing my sweater. And I'm thinking, no, this is not possible. But so curious, I run up to the child, of course scaring the living bejesus out of him, grab him by the collar, turn it over, and there is my name written on the collar of this sweater. I tell that story because it has served and continues to serve as metaphor to me about the level of connectedness that we all have on this earth. We so often don't realize what our action and our inaction does to people we think we will never see and never know.
That was Jacqueline Novogratz at a conference held by TED, a nonprofit group that showcases leading thinkers. As you heard, Novogratz had been a U.S. banker before heading to work in Africa. Her first project there landed her in Ivory Coast, where she was in charge of a microloan program. But things didn't go quite as well as she had hoped.
On the good side was this young spirit with lots of confidence and energy. I'd cut my hair off to look like Margaret Mead, you know, the whole thing. On the bad side, I showed up really thinking that I could figure out myself how we were going to solve problems of poverty. When I first arrived in the Ivory Coast, I was pretty much told in no uncertain terms that I was too young, no children, didn't know Africa, had a very limited ability to speak French, and frankly wasn't wanted.
And that was from the women mostly, wasn't it? The women that you went to help.
That's right. And in truth, they were right. I could have been presented differently. I could have been introduced differently. I could have presented myself differently. I could have come as a learner. And the gift they gave me, although it was an incredibly painful time, was to tell me the truth. And I think I learned the need for greater humility very quickly.
You learned that lesson the hard way, but you were just relentless. You went on then to Rwanda later, where the women were actually quite receptive. What happened in Rwanda?
Well, in part, I think I felt like a failure. And so I was relentless because I didn't want to come home having failed. So I had left Ivory Coast and I was living in Kenya. And these three women walked into my office one day and they were from Rwanda, which at the time was a very obscure country in the middle of Central Africa.
This was before the genocide.
This is before the genocide, way back in early 1986. And they asked me if I would come to Rwanda to work with them and explore the feasibility of whether we could set up a microfinance institution for women. And I was so moved that African women would ask me to do something with them, that I was going to go, and I was not leaving until we had actually done more than establish whether this was feasible or not, but in fact had established it.
Maybe you could tell us a little bit about what made these women unique and how your work with them helped launch an incredible program for poor women in Rwanda.
There were actually five of them. Three had come to my office originally, but the five included three parliamentarians and another woman who worked in the Ministry of Finance and Social Affairs, which was a ministry that focused on family issues. And another was a very young woman we ended up hiring. But the parliamentarians were extraordinary. They wanted to change the world for women and make 50% of the population for the first time in the country's history really have a chance to participate in a full way. And we would work morning till night. It was an incredibly exciting time. I really adored these women. One in particular became a real mentor to me in teaching me the ways of Rwanda, the ways of negotiating power from her seat as a parliamentarian, but with a disadvantage because she was a woman. I think of that time as one of the most important times in my own life, thanks to the five women with whom I work so closely.
There were many other stories you told which helped me to get really insight into how much work it took you and takes others to really understand what people on the ground, how they really think and how to help them. One of the stories I really liked was the story of when
You, with some workers, went way out to a rural village to meet some of the people. And there were two women on the side of the road trying to sell these beautiful woven baskets they had made. It was the end of the day, and you kind of played a little game with them to try to figure out how to bargain with them and get them to make the money they needed.
Yeah, well, I love bargaining anyway. And one of the things that I loved about living in East Africa and Central Africa was that bargaining was a part of having conversation with people. I just enjoyed the whole interaction. And so these two women were sitting there. It was the end of the day, as you said. The market was shutting down. And I went up to them and I said, how much are your baskets? And each woman said the equivalent of $10. And I said, $10? I buy these baskets. And all the baskets look identical for $6 in town. And so I'll give you six. And the woman said, no, it's 10. So I went to the woman sitting next to that woman. Their knees were touching. And I said, how much is your basket? And she said, $10. And I said, well, wait a minute. I know that in town where the costs are higher, it's $6, and there's already a profit margin built in. So one of you could afford to go less than 10.
I want to say it wasn't that you were necessarily trying to get this great price. You were kind of trying to teach them a lesson in a market-driven economy.
Oh, sure, in marketing. Well, that's right. And I was being very playful.
Yeah, what were you trying to show them?
I wanted to learn the psychology because I had been working in the markets already, and so many things that I had taken for granted weren't working. You know, I would see women, rather than take a 12% loan per year, make a decision to buy tomatoes from the moneylender, who was also the supplier of tomatoes, and pay 10% per day. And that made no logical sense to me until I found out, only after sitting and listening and talking to the women, that the supplier of tomatoes, who was also the moneylender, essentially imputed the interest into the determination of whether you got good tomatoes or bad tomatoes. So if you said, look, I'll get my own loan rather than borrow from you, he would give you the bad tomatoes.
And you also had a problem with the church, didn't you? Didn't the church say they couldn't borrow money in that way?
I wouldn't say the whole church, but certainly, well, certain ministers who used the politics of their power, essentially, to say to some of the women in their congregation, this is usury. You can't take a loan from this organization because it's against the Bible, which was completely ironic and completely false because, again, our rates were 12% a year and the moneylender was 10% per day. It was constantly navigating that. And going back to the two women with their baskets, finally, I really laid it out for them. And I said, you know, if neither of you agrees to lower your price, I'm not buying a basket. One of you could lower the price, and even afterwards, you could split the profits. But there was such a need for solidarity. And also, I found out that they had made no sales for the whole day, and they needed to get back home to their villages. They needed to cover bus fare. I think the biggest gift for me in that whole experience, and as you said, there were many, many, many stories, was to teach me to listen really, really carefully, to start with the market as a great listening device, but then to pay attention and break through my own assumptions and understand what drives people to behave in certain ways, some that are driven by the markets and some that are driven by a completely different psychology and completely different set of variables.
Jacqueline, one of the major themes in your book is that traditional aid programs in Africa are often inefficient and sometimes don't work at all. And you, of course, learned that the hard way. What did you learn in your first few years about the way American donors and aid groups help people in the developing world, say Africa, and why it's not working well?
I think so often aid groups, which, you know, it's really important to say are very well-intentioned, fail. Sometimes starts with the aid being driven by politics rather than actual opportunity. And then I would say being driven by perceived need, again, rather than opportunity, that we look at, here's a problem that we want to solve, and then we throw money at it, bringing in what we think is the best solution, rather than listening to low-income people as active participants who want to make decisions in their lives. We rarely build in real systems of accountability. When I talk about accountability, what I've seen is that you talk to many people who run aid programs, and you ask them what their failures are, and they'll say, well, we don't have failures. Which is completely ironic and baffling when you look at how many aid programs have left just a litter of broken wells and broken mills without real change in people's economic situation. Finally, I think that, and again, it goes back to accountability and ownership, that we have program officers who dictate what should and should not be done, but these are people often who are moving every 2 or 3 years from post to post to post. And there's a whole other way that we could be doing this in such a more productive way by identifying local entrepreneurs, and there are extraordinary entrepreneurs in every country on the planet, investing in them, supporting them, and building on the things that do work and cutting off the things that don't with real systems of accountability. And so it's a completely different orientation. It's bottom up rather than top down. It insists on accountability. It focuses on equity and loans, investments, rather than just grants. It doesn't go through the government, but after private innovation has shown real models for success, then it goes to partner with government. In many ways, it's an inverted approach to what we've seen for the last 30 years of aid, which has been too often focused on the experts coming in with solutions from the top.
And you spent years learning this on the ground in Africa and India and many other countries. And as a result, you have founded and developed this Acumen Fund, which you're now running. How much money is the Acumen Fund loaning? And give me an example of how it actually works. You gave a wonderful abstract philosophy there, but I want to know, can you give me an example of what you're talking about?
So in short, Acumen Fund is a social venture, as a nonprofit venture capital fund, recognizing, as I said, with lots of conceptual language, that charity and aid by itself will not solve problems of poverty. It too often creates dependence. On the other hand, the market alone is not going to solve problems of poverty. And so Acumen Fund raises philanthropic money, and then we turn around and we invest only equity and loans in companies and nonprofits that are experimenting with what it takes to sell affordable housing, water, healthcare, energy to very low-income people in East Africa and South Asia. We have a little less than $40 million invested in about 40 investments in those regions. One example would be on long-lasting insecticide-treated malaria bed nets. Now, those bed nets are the nets that, you know, we use to cover beds in primarily in Africa to protect people from malaria. Traditionally, the nets have been made from polyester and had to be dipped in insecticide every 3 to 6 months to be effective. And of course, most people, being people, don't dip them. And they also rip really easily. So they weren't very effective. Well, Sumitomo from Japan comes along and they develop a much stronger net that lasts 5 years and doesn't have to be dipped in insecticide. But it's only being manufactured in East Asia, whereas 92% of all people who get malaria live in Africa. So UNICEF wanted to move nets into Africa. Sumitomo was very interested from a social responsibility perspective in exploring whether we might be able to manufacture those nets on the continent. So Acumen Fund used its patient capital, the kind of money we invest at below market returns that's willing to wait for a long time, supported by management assistance. We found who we thought would be the best entrepreneur on the continent in a company called A to Z Textile Manufacturing. We made a loan at below market rates, and I thought it back in 2003 that success would be the company producing 105,000 nets and employing 150 people. Today, A to Z employs 7,000 people, mostly low-income women, and they produce 20 million long-lasting bed nets per year. That kind of business orientation that is grounded in a humanitarian ethos, I think, really provides not the only way, but a really important way that we can be more effective at solving big problems of poverty.
You had another story, too, that I thought was very interesting. It took you days to get to this very remote area in India where you all were about to make a loan. And you talked about the situation there. The children weren't getting an education. When one of your workers asked someone to use their bathroom in a nice middle-class home, they were just sent to the backyard because there were no sanitary conditions. And yet what you were doing wasn't lending money necessarily for education and toilets, but you were supporting these small computer kiosks in remote villages, which to us here might think, why are you doing that when there's so many other needs? But tell us a little about why that worked.
That's a company called Drishti in India, and it's run by another terrific entrepreneur, Satyan Mishra. there's nothing more powerful than knowledge and access to information. And so what Drishti does is set up, as you said, these little kiosks that provide computer training, access to computers themselves, a telephone. And the people in the villages, despite the fact that they have very little amounts of money, were paying to get themselves trained, in part because the schools don't provide any training whatsoever. The teachers don't even show up. And today, Drishti operates in more than 4,000 villages. And so they're reaching more than 7 million people who are getting access to information and knowledge. What we also discovered in time, of course, is when you've got a distribution system set up in 4,000 villages, you have an opportunity to sell more than computer services. That's your anchor, if you will. And so now Drishti is experimenting with selling health insurance and drip irrigation products so that farmers can solve their own problems, too.
Jacqueline, you sum up pretty nicely at the end of your book what kind of people it's going to take to turn things around in the developing world when it comes to poverty and justice issues. And it's not just about compassion and big-heartedness. And it's also not just about being a great financial whiz or a banker. How would you describe the kind of person you look at for the Acumen Fund, for example?
We look for three major buckets, if you will. We look for people with financial experience. We look for people who also have an understanding of how to operate companies, how to build management systems. And then importantly, we look for people who have what we call moral imagination, the ability to put yourself in another person's shoes and to build solutions with them. We believe that the kind of leader who will really excel pushes away trite ideology and petty assumptions, that really is willing to build the hard-headed skills of what it takes to make an organization run, whether in the nonprofit sector, in the for-profit sector, or in government, with a real eye on accountability, with a real eye on what it takes to make something financially sustainable so that 6 or 7 or 10 years later, the well that was built continues to be there for people who own it, but also the understanding that this is hard and that part of leadership, particularly in doing the kind of work we're doing, is building systems that don't need you, that building systems that allow other leaders and the next generation of leaders to flourish and own long into the future after you're gone.
Jacqueline Novogratz, founder of the Acumen Fund, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
The book is called The Blue Sweater, Bridging the Gap Between Rich and Poor in an Interconnected World. The author, Jacqueline Novogratz, is head of the Acumen Fund. And just ahead, we go to downtown Shanghai for music and local munchies. Stay with us. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. Sometimes young women work as prostitutes because they've been lured into the business by pimps or forced into it by human traffickers. But in one community just outside Delhi, India, women are encouraged, even forced, to work as prostitutes by their husbands. Every day there, married women walk to nearby highways to meet their clients, usually passing truck drivers, while their husbands and mothers-in-law take care of the children. Reporter Sunita Thakur has more.
Under a tree in an open courtyard, a play is being put on about domestic violence. Some 30 women and girls dressed in their smartest saris or long baggy trousers and tunics sit in a semicircle, transfixed. They see a story unfold that they're both familiar with and have usually kept to themselves until now. The play is being put on by an organization called Apne Aap, which means helping yourself. The group tries to help women in prostitution find alternative livelihoods and a new future. In this scene, a woman who has refused to work as a prostitute is being beaten. Incredibly, it's her husband who's handing out the punishment. But the scene would come as no surprise to Rajita. The 25-year-old lies on a bed by the open door, other family chatting on the veranda outside. Her feet are propped up on a pillow, while her 3-year-old daughter plays with her hair. Rajita has been working as a prostitute for nearly 5 years.
In a lot of houses, There are fights when women refuse to go out and earn in this way. Husbands want money for their drinking, clothes, that kind of thing. So many are pressured in this way. They can't even stay a day at home, otherwise they'll be beaten.
Rajita insists she hasn't been forced into prostitution by her family, that she chose to go into it. But the question of choice for most women in this community is academic, since they've been conditioned from childhood to believe prostitution is the only way to earn a living. Rajita is 7 months pregnant and unable to work. But once her second child is born, she'll be back on the road to sell herself to passing truck drivers. It's a hard life for these women who grow old much before their time. The Kanabadosi community live cheek by jowl in tiny, brick, often unplastered dwellings on the outskirts of Delhi. The Kanabadosi settled on this piece of land in the 70s. Like many nomadic tribes over the last 40 years, the Kanabadosi found it increasingly difficult to earn a living through agriculture and had to settle down. But the men were unable to find work, so some of the women turned to prostitution. As they returned with apparently easy money in their pockets, others too were forced to follow the trade. Today, it has become a way of life for most of the women. Raj Kapoor is the first and so far the only man in this community to obtain a university degree. Kapoor now works for Apne Aap, trying to persuade Kanabadosi men that prostitution shouldn't be a way of life for their wives.
I say that you have a इज्जत एक जो होती है वो आपके पास नहीं है वो मेरे पास है
They think I'm mad. I tell them I have respect. You don't. But very few understand. Also, it's in-laws who create problems. For instance, in our community, we give money to the girl's family in marriage. What often happens is that once she comes to live with her in-laws, they start saying, "We took such a big loan for you. Now you have to pay it back."
Apne Aap is also reaching out to the women directly with a program that's led to major change in other regions where the organization works. Around 20 women sit close together in a courtyard, laughing awkwardly in this discussion group at Apne Aap Center. The women aren't used to talking or even thinking about their feelings, so they're often flummoxed by the nature of the discussions. For instance, what constitutes mental or physical violence? How do you tell the difference between consensual sex and just plain rape? These meetings are the first step in getting these women to share experiences and imagine an alternative life. Apne Aap's director, Ruchira Gupta, leads these meetings.
So these women also don't want to challenge the status quo because that's the only world that they know. So it takes about 2 or 3 years to find that level of consciousness within themselves, which the women find by sharing stories with each other and realizing how universal their subjugation is.
After an hour or so, the women want a break. They cajole the shy singing talent amongst them, a woman named Balwanti, to sing them a love song.
Jo humko samjhega ye sapna, ye sapna. दिल में समाए हैं प्यार का तो फलाए हैं बड़ी दूर से आए हैं प्यार का तो फलाए हैं
Apne Aap believes the best hope to put an end to prostitution in the Kanabadosi community lies with the next generation. These girls, between 10 and 18 years old, come to the center every day to learn skills such as sewing, embroidery, and basic literacy. Today, they're also rehearsing a play on trafficking of young girls. One by one, rather hesitantly, they stand and recite their lines. The play may have a long way to go yet, but 17-year-old Alka is happy to have joined the center. She says, before this, if a sudden calamity occurred at home, we would have to become prostitutes. But now we can stand on our own feet. Now with these skills, we can begin a business or something. Alka, like all the girls, was enrolled in the classes by her mother. And Apne Aap's director, Ruchira Gupta, says the mothers receive an indirect benefit from this.
Once they see the change in their daughters, then they begin to feel more self-confident and they start seeking a change for themselves, which is the biggest magic. And when that moment happens is when they start looking for other options and start pushing us and saying, we want another livelihood, tell us what can we do.
So, Apne Aap has helped the women form small self-help collectives. Four or five of them contribute 1 rupee a day, that's less than 10 cents, from their earnings. Once a minimum balance is reached, any member can take loans against it to start a small business. Rajita, the woman who's 7 months pregnant, has also been attending the women's discussion group. As a result, she's adamant that she doesn't want her daughter's life to turn out like hers.
I intend to educate my daughter in a private school so that she doesn't go that way. I want that she becomes a doctor, teacher, or something like that. It's for them that I am doing this work. If our kids continue with this, it'll never end.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Sunita Thakur in Delhi.
India's most sacred river, the Ganges, runs not far from Delhi. But reporter Peter Aronson first saw the river, one of the longest in the world, much farther east. He filed this reporter's notebook.
During a recent visit to the Indian state of Bihar, I had a chance to see the Ganges for the first time, and it's quite a scene. The river is as wide as the Mississippi. Its muddy banks are littered with countless little broken clay pots, just about the size of grapefruits, that one must step over to reach the water. These pots, it turns out, hold people's ashes. The Ganges River is holy to Hindus. They believe that if their ashes can be poured into her sacred waters, they're guaranteed a rebirth into favorable circumstances. It's a common sight to find photographs of the deceased stuck in the mud, along with ribbons, flowers, and other ceremonial offerings. And the river is not just for the dead. Hindus believe a single dip in the Ganges washes away a lifetime or more of sins. That's despite studies showing bacterial contamination of the water that's off the charts, thanks largely to raw sewage and industrial pollution. Even so, at the river's edge, I watched a family taking a holy bath in the river after a funeral, the women immersing themselves fully dressed in brilliantly colored saris, happily bathing in the river, and the men a few yards upstream going shirtless. I watched as three men washed a huge basket of ginger in the river before taking it to market. I asked an Indian friend if it was common for the produce sellers to wash their wares in the Ganges. Wash them, he replied, amused. On the opposite side, they grow them in the Ganges water. Behind the ginger sellers, ancient-looking wooden ferry boats, whose design probably hasn't changed in centuries, carry people from one side to the other. In all, it's a magical scene, but it's also a challenge to my senses. Because the level of the river changes all the time, what was river yesterday is just a muddy bank today. And so much of what gets dumped in the river is now underfoot, including those clay pots. It's a strange feeling knowing that I'm stepping on human remains with each footfall. But it's an entirely different sensation than stepping over someone's grave at a cemetery. After all, the ashes are mixed with mud and garbage and human waste. But no one seems particularly bothered. Here, along the Ganges, the sacred and the profane mix easily, and the dead and the living don't seem to mind sharing the river.
Peter Aronson is a freelance reporter based in northern India. And we stay in Asia now for the Top of the Pops. Here's what people are tapping their toes to in Shanghai this week. That's the rock group Tianmi de Haizu. Singing the popular song Yi Zheng Lan. Shanghai has a vibrant music scene. It also has some of the world's tallest skyscrapers.
On the streets below, in their shadows, are scores of street vendors. They're an important part of Shanghai's local economy, but they're constantly on the run from authorities who want to clean up the city's image before next year's World Expo. Rebecca Canther spent the day with a popcorn popper on a back street in Shanghai.
There are clear skies this afternoon. That's good news for Yan Zhaobao. The 41-year-old unloads his pushcart, setting down a stool, cauldron, wood chips and grains, everything he needs to make a living. Every day, Yuan heads out from the tiny shack where he lives with his mother, wife, and 4-year-old son. He pushes his cart more than an hour through bustling streets until he reaches a quiet, middle-class neighborhood, a good place to set up his mobile popping shop. After starting a fire in a metal can, Yuan scoops up popcorn kernels with a tin, pours them into a small iron cauldron, claps the hatch on tight, then flips the cauldron on its side and rotates it on a spit over the flame. As the heat and pressure rise, he pumps air to build the crackling flame. Yuan is a wandering vendor, so it's difficult to know where he'll turn up next.
One day I'm here, next day I'm there. I'm always moving around. If no one buys, I'll move on to another location. When people buy popcorn from me, they take a long time to finish the bag. So I change my location and return only after a few days.
He may be always on the move, but customers have no trouble knowing when he's open for business. After about 10 minutes of rotating the cauldron, he yells out a warning. Noise, noise, he shouts. He releases the hatch on the cauldron and explodes the popcorn into a large sack, setting off nearby car alarms in the process. Wherever Yuan goes, he attracts a crowd, curious about his odd-looking contraption and imitating its sound. Nowadays, people here can buy microwave popcorn in the supermarkets, but Yuan still pops corn the traditional way. Customers like this middle-aged man line up to take home freshly popped corn for 70 cents a bag. We eat this mostly as a form of nostalgia, he says. When we were kids, we ate it all the time. This isn't movie popcorn, that's for sure. No butter and salt here. Yuan flavors his with a dash of sugar instead. He makes puffed rice, too. It's an even bigger seller. It's not breakfast cereal, it's an all-day snack. Rice cakes, dried beans, even dried pasta. Yuan says he can pop them all.
There's so many things I can make with my popper. If it tastes good, I'll pop it.
Some argue vendors like Yuan should be banned for blocking roads. His biggest problem comes from the city administrators, known as the Chengguan, who are notorious for harassing street vendors.
The Chengguan are really terrible. We're like cats and mice. If they come, I just run. If they catch you, they'll confiscate your materials and fine you. I've been caught many times. My cart is big, so when they come by, I don't have enough time to collect everything and run before they catch me.
Popping grains is a common trade in Yuan's home province, 400 miles away. But in Shanghai, it's a job full of uncertainties. He dreams of a stable life, but his job requires him to move around, and renting a storefront would be too expensive. He can't afford the sanitation permits that food sellers have to have either. What do you want popped? He asks as a woman drops a few coins in his hand. On a good day of sales, he can sell 20 bags of popcorn, or $14 worth. But good days are hard to predict, and if it rains, he stays home. 2 decades of popping have taken a toll on him.
I hate this work. I don't want to do it, but I can't find any other way to get by.
Yuan doesn't even like to eat popcorn. After making it day in and day out, he can't stand the smell. But he still laughs when he thinks of his popper's sound. For the World Vision Report, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai, China.
Take a look at how the popcorn vendor pops his corn on our website, worldvisionreport.org. That's it for this week. Remember to check out our website, worldvisionreport.org. You can find blogs from our reporters and details on how to become a friend of the World Vision Report on Facebook. Our show is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Chris Baldiga is our production assistant. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is our engineering assistant. And I'm Peggy Waymire.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the organization.